All right, are we ready to press the magic button?
Yeah.
Living in a scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We've used science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness. But it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively? It'll be up to you, and you too.
Todd Workoven.
Hello, Mark Middleton.
How are you doing?
I am doing great.
Hey, did you hear about that little person that was escaping prison? It was climbing down the wall.
I did not.
You know, when I saw it, I thought to myself, now that's a little condescending.
That's dumb, but it got me to play with the new toy that you bought for the show, which really is sort of for me over here, which is called the Stream Deck.
Stream Deck.
Which is a little contraption that's kind of like a shortcut machine, but it's it could do, it looks like a ton more. It's for people, I think, who play streaming
like Twitch
stuff and Twitch.
And of, yeah, all the things.
But for me, it's a... It's a soundboard that I got to load all of my sounds onto. And I recorded the Unipiper slide whistle that I can use now.
Yep.
Or the full...
You're just going to metaphorically shoot your whole load right now.
I barely knew her.
Yes. But yes, this is a wonderful little gadget. I'm going to be very, very happy. Oh, and you did isolate the wonderful sound clip from Lou Dobbs.
Lou Dobbs.
So we have two different versions. We have the...
The Mexican city of Huatulda.
And the shortened...
Huatulda.
You can take a really, like, oh, my dog just died, and turn it around really quickly with just one word.
It really works in every situation.
It works everywhere.
Just change your inflection, I guess. Welcome to another episode of the Mark and Toddcast. I'm Todd Workoven, here with Mark Middleton and our new toy.
And our new toy.
Oh, and I have, I'm gonna just finish it off now because I was able to make a whole folder. Easy. A whole folder of...
I am an actress. I am a U.S. television personality.
I am global warming.
Perfect.
Oh, that's fun. So yeah, you can make your own folders, and it's just wonderful.
You're pretty excited over there.
So I know. I'm going to have to... I'll set it aside for right now. I was watching... I think I sent you a link... somebody posted on my Facebook feed some old industrial video about steel making.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like 45 minutes long. It looks to be made in like the late 80s, early 90s. And I was just transfixed with this video of the steel making process. But I can't figure out, because it's like, it's those things where you have like the big, what do you call them? Not cisterns, but like the giant vats.
Yeah.
That, you know, are hoisted up four stories and they're sloshing with the liquid metals that have been melted. I don't understand what they make all of that machinery out of. Because they're like, here in our blast furnace, it gets 2,000 degrees. And like, what are we making that out of and how?
So they're called ladles.
Ladles.
Yeah. As a vessel used to transport and pour out molten metals. I'm reading this fast as I can.
But yeah, it became one of those, like, can God make a rock so heavy right. He can't lift it? It's like, crucible, there we go. That's probably what I was thinking of. But I don't understand. I would like to maybe see a whole documentary on the process of making those things.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's similar to steel. It's just doped with something. It's got other alloys added or other metals added into it to make it. It's not that it needs to be hard. It needs to be a higher melting point.
Right.
And so
right.
You're just raising the melting point. And you can add
but then what,
things to
but
metals.
But then you have to make that in machinery. So then you have to have that machinery be able to withstand heat more than the crucible. And then that machinery had to be made by something that... So
well,
like
at some point you can... cast something in clay, for example.
Oh.
And then you shape it into something else by pounding it and bending it and everything. So,
sending in the servants to into the blast furnace to pound out the metal. Uh-oh, I lost half of my...
I did too.
Half of my... Oh, there
we go.
Now we're back.
Okay.
All right, well, I won't dwell on that, but it made me think of those infrared thermometer. Is that what, like, you'd take this... It's like the surface temperature is.
Yeah, yeah.
How do those work?
I don't... You know...
Like, it just doesn't seem like it does, but we all...
We... So, in the Navy, we had... Nifties. They were the there was a acronym that it spelled out, but it basically looks at firefighting. It looks for hot spots, and so it's just a thermal imager.
Oh, okay.
So a Nifty thermal imager.
Imager.
I barely knew words.
Oh, look how fast that was.
Look at that. And and so I think that those temperature sensors are essentially just a one pixel version of one of those, where it's got a LEDs and infrared sensors are very similar. One projects light, one takes electricity and makes it into light. You can also have an IR sensor that receives light and converts it into electricity. And so light or other electromagnetic radiation, including infrared heat being given off by something. So you're just measuring the electromagnetic radiation coming off of it in a specific frequency, converting that to electricity and sending it off to a sensor.
I guess that stuff is just
it is
mind legged. I was one of my YouTube channels is I was watching all about how magnetic tape works and like different kinds of recordings that they did in the 40s and 50s and all the evolution of that, which has been fascinating. And
it is mind-blowing.
The closest I can come to figuring that the magnetic tape out is that it's just, I mean, magnetizing the tape, obviously, but in little thin strands, and as long as you pull it as fast as you're supposed to, and it just moves the speaker, the magnetic strength of that little signal that passes on the tape.
Yeah.
And it's just insane.
It is mind-blowing
how all that stuff works. Huh. All right. Well, moving on. We're going to talk about numbers for a little bit because that's always exciting. So, Nate Heath of Not Nerds knows how we love the, there's been just about, this and this. And so sent me, spaceships are now older than airplanes were when we first flew our spaceships. So when we first flew our first human space flight in 1961 was 57 years after we invented the airplane. And now it has been 57 years plus, you know, however long between the first spacecraft taking off and now.
And yeah, if you think about there were plenty of people alive when Yuri Gagarin went into space the first time that were alive when the Wright brothers sailed on Kitty Hawk.
Right.
And
I mean, that's mind blowing.
Yeah.
57 years. I wonder, do you think we've come as far in those 61 years or just not? I mean, I guess in other areas we have, but it seems like in flight and space travel, I mean, I guess that's kind of evened off a little bit. I mean, you can only have so much technological advancement, I guess. We are going to Mars and into wherever.
Totally. NASA just set a date for the, we've been without humans launching from American soil into space since the last space shuttle. And so they've set a date for our next astronauts will be flying in SpaceX Dragon capsules.
Dragon capsules?
Yeah, the Dragon is the name of the capsule.
Oh, okay.
And
sounds like a Pokemon battle. We're going to send our Dragon capsules into space before China gets there.
Remind me of, let's talk about Go.
Okay. Well, then I'll go on. Did you get me, this is really just a conversation between you and I that I wrote down on my thing. Did you give me that 3D pen?
Yes.
Okay. So last Yeah,
like a year ago.
Like a while ago. Yeah, two years ago or so. But then there's a couple things that were in here, but little Todd and I took it on family vacation and we used all what I thought was all of our thing. And I was going through my closet and I found 6 more rolls of the spools that I got. So now I'm all excited because I have all of that. I thought it was over for me, but now the excitement has begun again. So re-thanks for that.
Speaking of Christmas gifts, and we'll talk more about numbers if you got more of that. So we've been surrounded, especially in this last year, by more and more kids.
Yeah.
So, Brian and Sarah had Scarlett at the end of December last year. So she's 11 months old.
The Turners,
baby Alex. And, they're not quite the age that, this applies for yet, but I've got a niece and I've got a friend at work that has a little boy that's 5, all these like 4 or 5 year olds that are in my life right now. And so I found the perfect gift on Amazon and it's called a Yelly.
Wow. So it looks like a cute little,
it looks like a little
spider, like a yellow fun spider,
plush spider. And you put it onto a hard surface.
Okay. Oh, and it kind of glows and it's, oh, it's crawling around a little bit. Oh, it's fast. Oh, it's very fast. All right, so it lights up a little bit.
The more you yell at it, the faster it goes.
Okay, hold. Is it just, it is sound activated.
It's sound activated.
Oh, my God.
And so it goes slow when you speak softly.
Hey! What a terrible, awful gift to give parents. That's amazing.
And so we bought them in bulk. And
that thing's speedy, too. We'll have to take it out into the the open land of your living room. That is amazing. Yellies. That is the worst when you buy parents' kids that, or the gifts that they either can't remove the batteries or there's no off switch. Or
right. Nick by his best friends. She had 2 kids and her new husband had 2 kids and they're all like early teens and everything. This was like 10 years ago and he bought them all vuvuzelas.
That is the worst thing to ever do to someone. That is hilarious. Vuvuzelas. I had one more number thing to put things into perspective.
Oh, yeah.
So how long would it take to count 1,000,000 seconds?
Ooh, 1,000,000 seconds. So 3,600 an hour. And it would.
I didn't realize we were doing on air math. I just
8,600. I think 1,000,000 seconds is a few weeks. I think it's like 3 weeks.
Okay. It is 12 days, so about 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
So how much time would it take to count 1,000,000,000,000 seconds?
Geez.
So 1,000,000 seconds is 12 days, or 1,000,000,000 seconds, excuse me. 12 days for 1,000,000, many for 1,000,000,000?
Okay, so 2 weeks is 1,000,000. So 500,000 weeks... No, 500 weeks would be 1,000,000,000. And so that would be 100 years.
You may calculate.
And so it will be, to go to 1,000,000,000,000 would be 100,000 years. I'm off by 4% because there's 52 weeks in a year, not 50, which is what I did my math on. So I'm off by 4%.
Well, that's because you're not a mathematician.
I am an actress.
This is true.
So it takes 12 days for 1,000,000 seconds.
Okay.
For 1,000,000,000 seconds, it takes 31 years.
Okay, I was totally off.
For 1,000,000,000 seconds, it would be 31,700 years. But the difference between 12 days and 31 years is 1,000,000,000 and 1,000,000,000.
Yeah.
And to think about like corporate profits.
Right.
And like trickle down, whatever. I mean, it's just, it's in, yeah. it, just that different. And we always think, well, it's 1 million, and it's just 1 and 2 and 3 of this. But it's, I mean, wow. that is amazing. 31 years
that's a really
for a billion
good,
seconds.
That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, 12 days. And that, yeah, 12 days versus 31 years.
Did we talk about Singles Day in China last episode? So Singles Day is 11/11, our Veterans Day.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I think we might have.
And on... during the Singles Day holiday, they call it Singles Day because it's all ones, one, one,
oh,
one, one.
Okay.
And it started as buy things for your single friends, and it evolved into buy everything for everyone, magnified much bigger than Christmas.
Wow.
And so the Christmas holidays, you know, for Cyber Monday and for Black Friday each amount to about $10 billion. And Singles Day amounts to almost $40 billion of sales. And so you just...
Yeah, a billion is 1,000 million.
Yes.
I mean, come on. All right. Well, speaking of Beijing, to judge every resident based on their behavior by the end of 2020. Yes. China's plan to judge each... of its 1.3 billion. So you can go back and see how long it would take to count each one of those billion people if you counted one per second. Based on their social behavior is moving a step closer to reality, with Beijing set to adopt a lifelong points program by 2021 that assigns personalized ratings for each resident. They will pool the data with several departments to reward and punish some 22 million citizens based on their actions and reputations. Those with the so-called better social credit will get the, quote, green channel benefits, while those who violate laws will find life more difficult. The Beijing project will improve blacklist systems so that those deemed untrustworthy will be, quote, unable to move even a single step. According to the government's plan. That's from the government, not like
right.
a social critic who's warning us. That's like how they're selling it.
Yeah, exactly. And they're already starting to shut off regional travel. So you can't book a flight.
Yes, more than 11 million flights and 4 million high-speed train trips have blocked some of its citizens with bad credits, according to the National Development and Reform Commission. So you can get good credit and through pro-social behavior such as volunteer work and blood donations, while punishing those who violate traffic laws and charge under-the-table fees. Different agencies will link to the database, blah, blah, blah. So we all have that to look forward to. Didn't they used to, I think for like 20 minutes, there was some app that it was like rate your friends, and it was like aimed at high schoolers or whatever. Yes. It was just like the worst thing ever.
Well, this is all just pointing right at the Black Mirror episode.
You know, I still haven't watched Black Mirror. I should.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm finishing up a Haunting of Hill House tonight, so maybe I'll move off from Black Murder.
Haunting of Hill
House. It's been good. I'll reserve all of my judgment until after the last one, but I start off really strong. The last three episodes have been a little,
yeah.
Let's all sit down and just talk exposition for 20 minutes.
But the last episode's even worse.
Anyway, that, oh, dear.
So, sorry.
Well, scientists unravel the secret of cube-shaped wombat feces.
Ah, yes.
Spelled in its the alternate feces, because this is from Europe, so it's right. F-A-E. Oh, it probably has that fancy connected
A-E.
A-E. Yeah. With dye-shaped dung... This article is a little over the top. Wombats boost the odds that their droppings deposited near burrow entrances do not roll away. At least that's what they think. But quite how the animals produce the awkward-shaped blocks, they can pass up to 10 per night, has proved harder to work out. So they they've made little progress beyond ruling out the nagging suspicion that the animals possess square anuses, which is my favorite sentence of the week. So they've ruled that out. To gain new insights, they've started studying the digestive tracts of ones that have been struck by cars and trucks in Tasmania. Close inspection revealed that the wombat's excrement solidified in the last 8% of the intestine, where the feces built up as blocks of the size of long and chunky sugar cubes. So it's all about how the last part of the intestine does not stretch evenly, unlike the rest of the intestine. And when measured around the circumference, some parts give more than others. So that allows the intestine to deform in such a way that packs feces into cubes rather than the usual sausage shape. Ooh, do you have a picture? Oh, yeah, there it is. Wow, those are really cubed.
They are cubed.
They are cubed feces.
They're pooping a brick.
So they believe the revelation will have implications among this small community of researchers who are studying the wombat scat. Today, engineers have only two methods for making cubes. You either mold them or cut them. The wombat's intestines suggest a third route is possible. So they're looking into perhaps a cool method to apply to the manufacturing process. We can learn from the wombats and apply this to our manufacturing process. So let's hear it for the wombat's cube poop.
To cool it?
To cut it. The only two ways to make cubes.
Cut it and mold it.
Mold it or cut it.
And what's the third?
We don't know yet. That's why we're searching the anuses of wombats.
Nice.
For that secret third way to make cubes. Cards Against Humanity is going to buy an area of the U.S. border to prevent the border wall. Quote, we've purchased a plot of vacant land on the border and retained a law firm specializing in eminent domain to make it as time-consuming and expensive as possible for the wall to get built, the company said. If the wall gets built, the government using eminent domain to acquire private land along the border would be the big hurdle. So they're just planning on taking up as much time as they can with that. I always like those little poke in the eye to social things like that people do. The little big FUs to things that we can't stop anyway. So we might as well do it.
And those guys are just such shits.
Yeah.
And they're great about it.
Didn't they one Christmas just raise money to dig a hole in the ground? And as long as they got money, they just kept digging the hole.
Yep, exactly.
And they gave away nothing.
They gave away nothing or like dirt or something. They're like,
I think it was just a box of nothing.
Box of nothing? Yeah.
Just like
and
this.
And on the product page, they're like, this is not ironic. You are actually getting nothing. We will send you an empty box. And then people were pissed when they got an empty box. And you're like, but
who could have known?
Who could have known?
That's funny. The largest peanut allergy study points to a life-saving treatment. So children diagnosed with a severe allergy took part in a trial where they were given increasing amounts of peanut protein over the year. The landmark trial found the participants not normally able to tolerate exposure to even a tenth of a single peanut could eventually cope with two whole peanuts. I wonder if that's two like shelled peanuts, because sometimes there's more in there.
Right.
We'll have to further study that. Just keep shoving peanuts. Jerry Seinfeld had a joke about finding the level of medicine that you're supposed to take is that they just kept giving it to someone until they died, and then they just backed it off a little bit. So maybe that's what we did with the peanuts too. We just kept forcing them peanuts and just backed it off one. So it is believed by gradually building up tolerance levels, allergy sufferers could protect themselves from accidental exposure. The allergy is rarely outgrown and is the most common case of food allergy deaths. So they just gradually exposed the kids with allergies over a length of time to more and more of it, and they were able to tolerate more and more of it. So that's some good news. In the meantime, Oxford Dictionary announces a couple new words of the year. Toxic is the word of the year, and gaslighting and tech lash are among words. Have you ever heard of tech lash?
I have not.
So toxic is, of course, let's see, do they give an official definition? It doesn't. I don't care all that much about toxic. Gaslighting is the action of manipulating someone by psychological means into accepting lies or false reality or making them doubt their own sanity. Let's see. The tech lash describes, quote, a strong and widespread negative reaction to the growing power and influence of large technology companies, particularly based in Silicon Valley. Oh, so like backlash, but with tech.
Right. Yeah, so like the new tech lash against Facebook because they're blah, 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 blah.
The only thing that interests me about that is the word portmanteau, which I always forget, but is great. It's just when you shove two words together, like my favorite word of all time, urinalysis, because it just blends so perfectly. So make your notes at home. That's Todd's favorite word, urinalysis. New York taxpayers get to pay $48,000 per Amazon job coming to their state. So New York is kicking in $1.5 billion in taxpayer-funded incentives to get half of Amazon's second headquarters located in Queens. Amazon made its long-awaited announcement on Tuesday, saying Long Island City and Alexandria, Virginia, will each get $25,000 jobs. They will also receive as yet unspecified incentives in New York. New York offered nearly triple that of what Virginia offered. While Tennessee offered a little bit more, but they said no, I guess. In a statement released by Amazon, they said, "Oh, the Andrew Cuomo. That can't be Andrew Cuomo. What year is this? Wasn't he like the mayor of New York in like the 70s? Maybe it's a different Cuomo."
Was that Mario Cuomo?
Maybe I think of Mario Cuomo. Anyway, some Cuomo, one of the collective Cuomos called the agreement, quote, one of the largest, most competitive economic development investments in U.S. history. However, New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson issued a statement saying, quote, Amazon is one of the richest companies in the world. I don't understand why a company as rich as Amazon, who I believe just passed the trillion mark, speaking of numbers, I don't understand why they need nearly $2 billion in public money for its expansion when New York desperately needs affordable housing, transportation, infrastructure, and education. So over the next 20 years, they hope to have a tax revenue of $10 billion. So
the rich get richer. The richest get richer.
I need to figure out how to get my life taxpayer funded like that.
Let's
that
start
the
a
way
cult.
To go.
Let's start a religion.
What would a cult be about?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I have nothing funny to play to that. All right. One last quick thing. The Art Institute of Chicago has put more than 50,000 high res images online. So you can now and available without restrictions. So you can go and really look at like super detailed pictures from their art collection and use them however you see fit, I suppose. And that's made available under the Creative Commons Zero license.
Oh, nice.
So they can be downloaded for free on the artwork pages. So that's the Art Institute of Chicago.
Hmm.
So there is that. Let's take a little break only so I can play a little thing off my... So that's the Tig Honk, which you named that as just Tig Notaro. Is that who does that?
Yeah. That's her doing the impression of
which is
clown
better,
whistle.
Which is better than the clown horde I had. Oh, I forgot to play. Let me go back here. Hold on. I forgot something very, very important. It is believed that by gradually building up peanut tolerances, allergy sufferers could protect themselves from accidental exposure.
A moment ago, I ordered peanuts.
Well played.
That wonderful clip from the movie Defula, which we did on Portland at the Movies, the live episode.
Have you heard about the Silent and Simple Ion Engine?
Ooh, I have not.
So there was a demonstration of an ion engine this last week. So an ion engine is a propulsion system with no moving parts.
It's like the ion cannon in Star Wars.
It's like an ion cannon in Star Wars.
I don't know what an ion is, I don't think.
So an ion is...
except that
everything
particle. Sold at the Sharper Image had ions either coming out of it or being trapped by it. So they're
flowing into you or through you or whatever. So an ion is a charged particle. And so if you've got an atom that is missing an electron, then that becomes an ionic element, basically an ionic atom. That charged particle that comes away from it is in itself an ionic element. So they take fuel of some sort and strip away electrons from it magnetically, basically, and then shoot the electrons out using charged plates that create a magnetic field between them, and they accelerate those electrons away from them, and that creates a thrust. And so you have no fan or turbo or moving part at all. It's just electric plates and such. And so they've created a prototype of a airplane in a big hangar flying with just an ionic engine. So there's no moving parts in this vehicle. And the implications are pretty profound.
Speaking of the space race.
Let's see if I can find a picture. I saw a video of it. Ionic.
We have an ionosphere, don't we?
We do. It's got a bunch. Ion drive, the first flight. Let's see if this has. They're talking about it. It looks like
talk
it.
Nope. Talk about it. Oh. So it's like a little. That looks like it's from Star Wars because that is a computer generated.
but that one, that's a big long video with just the little clip in there. There it goes again.
Weird.
And
it
so
looks like a little tiny glider thing.
Yeah, and so they have demonstrated it's there and actually
so what
working.
What powers it?
Electricity, ultimately. Like you're using electricity
plugged into the wall
To use very similar to the coils in a
maglev.
No,
trying to figure out what you're doing in your hand there, and I've got nothing. Picking fruit.
I'm making the
making
symbol
a pie.
Of
the claw machine.
Before we had semiconductors, we had tubes. So you had tubes.
Oh, okay.
That's a tube
that was a vacuum,
going into a radio.
Okay, wow, vacuum that was tube. A vacuum tube.
So a vacuum tube essentially is creating a stream, like your CRT is creating a stream of ions.
That was another.
It's same kind of thing. You're heating an element through charged plates, and that accelerates those electrons away. So that movement is creating a force of propulsion ultimately. And so you're able to transmit that into a thrust. Yeah.
That's
and so,
crazy.
And so the implications at
is there
the
any
space
heat?
Level, I'm sure that there's
some
generated here, but the implications for space travel are extreme because if you have a little, you know, nuclear fission reactor kind of thing that you can generate power from. Once you have electricity, then you can create thrust with that electricity without having to expend a fuel that is, you know, bursting that fuel into space. You can just strip away electrons and throw those into
space.
That's
crazy.
So there's some really crazy implications for this.
That reminds me, the ion thing reminds me of one of the other RetroTech videos that I watched all about how the CRT televisions worked and how television was invented. That is just insane as well.
Yeah.
All the tubes and the firing ions and the screens and the diffusers and the, it's amazing.
In Rigby, Idaho, there's the museum.
From
the guy that.
From the guy.
Farnsworth.
I was going to say Richard Farnsworth, but I don't think that's right. He's an actor. All right. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit today about something that came up over Thanksgiving, actually. You had a wonderful Thanksgiving here that you and Nick put on that had 20, 25 people or something like that.
Yeah, like 13, yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Because of the kids that were there,
it felt like
seemed
that.
Like a lot.
No, but it was wonderful. The Unipiper was here. Mosho, the cat rapper, was here, and his wife and Sarah's parents. And towards the end of the night, there was a 4-year-old that was here, and there was lots of and you made your special Chinese yams. Tell people about that because that was pretty exciting.
Yeah. So when I was in Shanghai, I had a dish there that. Seemed like really complex, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'd never be able to do that. And then I talked to some Chinese friends and people who lived in China, and they're like, oh, it's actually pretty easy. And then I looked up some videos, and so you fry yams or sweet potatoes. You can do it with either, And so took yams, fried them so that they're nice and crispy, and then took sugar and some water and created a molten lava of candied sugarness. And then you mix the two and serve it on a plate. When you pick them up, you create all of the little candy strings as it pulls away, and then you dip that immediately into cold water to quench it and to harden the sugar. And so now you have a candied yam that is covered in Wonder candy. It's very much could be served as a dessert or as an appetizer in China or whatever.
But yeah, it turned out really, and it was a really fun experience for everyone, like to dip their little yam into the water and then eat it. It was really good. And it left all the string. Somebody got cut by sugar glass
cuts in the kitchen while doing dishes from, you know, trying to extract these. Because after 3 minutes of being on the plate, it just hardens into a brick of just impenetrable sugar potato mix. And so it's a quick, brief little experience you get, and then you're done with it. And then they try to clean off the plate, and two people cut themselves doing that. Awesome.
But yeah, that was really good. And then, of course, there was lots of treats and candies cakes and all of that. And by the end of the night, the four-year-old who had just been mainlining candies and sugar and all night, didn't have any of the real food, just had all of the sugar, was just bouncing off the walls, crazy. And, of course, crashes right before he left.
Right.
And so we were all talking about, how he was all sugared up. And one of my, I usually forget all of the things that I learn, which is why someday when I listen back to the whole run of this show, I'm going to be very excited again to relearn it all. But one of the things that I always remember is that still science has not made a connection, in fact, they've said the connection is false, that sugar causes hyperactivity in children. Now, when you say that to parents, when you say that to anyone who's ever been around a child ever and has eyes, they'll say that can't be right. I think that there maybe is something going on that we just haven't figured out yet. That's my guess. But I was talking with Sarah, the Unipiper's wife, about that. And of course, she's like, oh, that can't be right. And so I went and I pulled up the study from the New England Journal of Medicine that was done. And so I kind of wanted to walk a little bit through what the research on sugar in and hyperactivity is. Now, it did look at actual sugar, sucrose, and a couple of the artificial sweeteners were used as the control for the double-blind studies. So researchers examined children whose parents thought they were sensitive to sugar, and they got about 25 kids together. This is a really long article, and it was all like the methodology article, so I just kind of pulled some of the things out of it that I thought were good. It was a double blind study, and they did cognitive and behavioral tests, medical tests, all of that. Talked to the parents, teachers, all those, and finally picked their subjects. So they did a double blind controlled trial with two groups of children, and they exposed them to one diet was high in sucrose with no artificial sweeteners. The other was low in sucrose and contained aspartame as a sweetener. And the third was low in sucrose and contained saccharin. So saccharin and which they call a placebo. Interesting. Mm. And all the diets were essentially free of additives, artificial food coloring, preservatives, all the stuff was controlled. The results for the children described as sugar sensitive, there were no significant differences among the three diets for the 39 behavioral and cognitive variables. For the preschool children, only 4 out of the 31 measured different significantly, but there was no consent pattern in the differences that were observed. So even when intake exceeds typical dietary levels, dietary sucrose does not affect children's behavior or cognitive function. And of course, they blame the fact that it's usually everyone's like, oh, he must be sugared up. Lots of times you have sugar at a birthday party.
Right. And all of the other ancillary things that would go, you know, I've got at a birthday party or at a amusement park or at, you know.
Or even here, like trapping a four-year-old in two small rooms all night long with no other children.
With all the adults.
All the exciting and noise and all that stuff.
And then Nick gives him gourds and and he's just throwing on top stuff of the world
into the fire. And
totally.
So they do say that parents will either say, well, my kid's especially sensitive or whatever, but it's just the attribution that we're all making for that. Despite subjective reports about the behavior effects of sugar and aspartame, most controlled studies have found no consistent adverse effect. But despite the lack of data demonstrating the behavior or cognitive effects of sugar, subjective reports on such adverse effects continue to be widespread. And they say that's because mostly our parents are saying that the effect is there. So over and over, the findings were negative, even though older children were selected because their parents believed them to be sensitive to sugar. And even though the children in both groups ingested substantial amounts of the sweeteners, and the few differences that they saw were actually consistent with a slight calming effect than with hyperactivity. What else do we have here? So despite the generally negative findings of the study, it is possible that there are some children who respond adversely to sugar. So every parent will say, well, my kid must be the one that is adversely reacted to sugar. Other subjects had average or above average intelligence, and the children were and children with less intellectual ability may respond differently. So apparently if your children are dumb, sugar might be worse for them. So you have to do that fine line of my child is sensitive to sugar, but he's not dumb. he's not dumb. So we must conclude from this carefully controlled 9-week study that neither sucrose nor aspartame produces discernible cognitive or behavioral effects in normal preschool children or in school age children believed to be sensitive to sugar. So this was, again, from the New England Journal of Medicine, and the article had pages and pages of the methodology and what they did and charts and graphs and all of that stuff that they did to study it. So that was an interesting article, but still, there has been no scientific link between sugar and hyperactivity, which I always just find fascinating. So
we do see a direct correlation in our family with Nick's intake of caffeine and craziness.
Yes.
That is a stimulant, that is a drug.
And has been studied to show all of that, too. Yeah. But there were things that said, well, you know, people say it's not direct, but it raises glucose level and all that. But like our liver does that, like other things control that for us. Right. So if you still don't believe it, I guess you can do your independent studies and prove all of science wrong. But until then, it does not look like sugar will make you any more hyper than.
If only there were a button that released the fake news soundbite.
You are fake news.
What else do we have? Okay, I'll finish going through it.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Well, now it's too loud.
And this one again.
Warfulda.
I do want to get Nate from Not Nerd trying to say vulnerable, which he always stumbles over. We have...
She's fantastic, made of plastic.
And that's all I could fit on one screen. So, what a fun toy the Stream Deck is. Merry early Christmas to the Mark and Toddcast. Speaking of, you can hear Mark and I and the Unipiper on Portland at the movies. We just did a live episode at the second annual Portland Podcast Festival about the movie Defula, which was an amazing movie.
No one can hear you scream.
No one can hear you scream. And what was I talking about it with you guys? Because that obviously Alien used is Alien or Aliens in space. No one can hear you scream. Defula predates Alien,
right?
But used No One Can Hear You Scream. So I'm wondering if that was just added in a reissue, because there's no way like Alien stole that from Defula, but you never know. It's an obscure horror hit from the mid-70s. But next week we will be back with Portland at the Movies with our Christmas movie called How Sarah Got Her Wings,
which you can preview on Netflix, I believe.
Yes, yeah. Netflix for free. One of our movies is for free, finally. So if you are a fan of Christmas movies, you can go watch How Sarah Got Her Wings. We will be doing that next week. A couple personal plugs next week also, which is December 2nd. I will be at Landmark Saloon selling my notebooks and lamps at the last minute holiday market. And then on the 15th and 16th, I will be with Brian the Unipiper downtown at a pop-up store. I'm not sure where. Maybe I should look at that. In the meantime, we'll just listen to this silence.
The Mexican city of Guadalajara.
Let's see here.
Brian's a moment ago, I ordered peanuts.
Moment ago, I ordered peanuts.
So that is whatever is on 803 Southwest Morrison. What shop is that?
803 Southwest.
Last year it was at the mall downtown.
Yeah, that's gonna be. Isn't that near Pioneer Courthouse Square?
Pioneer Courthouse Square. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Oh yeah, it looks like it's at the mall again. Let's see, right next to Brunch Box. So yeah, 803 Southwest Morrison. I think we're ready to be done here. I'll just lop off this whole last minute. You can hear us on the Fun Employment Radio Network as well. So tune into them. Their live shows, you can get extra behind the scenes stuff. So that is worth looking into as well. Other than that, I'm going to take you out with a song that I've been stuck in my head, which is not Baby Shark, but a song we're learning for Sunday school that our little 3-year-olds are going to sing in front of church that I realized was a Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis song called I Saw the Light. So we will see you guys later. Thank you for listening. Like, it's technically the Jesus Came Like a Stranger in the Night is kind of based on a verse, but it seems terrifying. I don't want Jesus coming at me like a stranger in the night. I want Jesus coming at me like someone I know that I would feel safe at night. Anyway. All right. See you guys next time.
Bye.